I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. 15 years ago, Louis D. Druel published Pacific Seaweeds. It sold 10,000 copies, and now a new updated and expanded version has just been published. Pacific Seaweeds, A Guide to Common Seaweeds of the West Coast, is a visually stunning book in full color that allows the reader to identify various species of seaweed found in and around British Columbia. There are recipes, too. Louis Druel and Bridget E. Clarkston join me now. They co-authored this new book. I'll ask them about their work with seaweed as well as seaweed's vital place in the ecosystem. Louis Druel is professor emeritus at Simon Fraser University, where he taught and researched kelp for 36 years. He was instrumental in establishing the Bamfield Marine Sciences Center. He lives in Bamfield, where he and his wife Ray Hopkins operate Canadian Kelp Resources Limited. He is the co-author of a previous book, Cedar, Salmon, and Weed. Bridget Clarkston is a seaweed biologist, educator, and photographer. She teaches at California State University, Monterey Bay, and has taught at the University of British Columbia and the University of New Brunswick. She is the author of A Field Guide to Seaweeds of the Pacific Northwest, published by Harbor Publishing, which publishes this book. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program in Bamfield, British Columbia, Louis Druel. Dr. Druel, good morning.
Good morning.
And in Monterey Bay, Bridget Clarkston. Dr. Clarkston, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. I'll begin with Louis, as you're the expert on kelp. Not all seaweeds are kelp, is that correct?
That's right. Kelp are just large brown seaweeds.
And I guess seaweeds encompass sea grass. Are there sea plants at all?
Well, yes, there are. There's a full range. So plants in the ocean consist of several large groups of algae,
mm-hmm.
and also some flowering plants, and some things which you would even call like bacteria.
I see. And I'm speaking to you today from Vancouver. You're up in Bamfield. The Bamfield Marine Sciences Center, you helped found that. How long ago was that?
That was 68 when we first located Bamfield as a site for the marine station.
And that's an ideal place, isn't it? Because you have the variety of species. They're countless, aren't they?
Yes. It's a very rich flora here.
Bridget, you took the photo on the cover, is that right?
I did.
Yeah, what are we looking at?
The photo on the cover is a pile of Nereocystis, or bull kelp, washed up on the shores of Brady's Beach. In Bamfield.
And you're in California now. You spent a lot of time up here in British Columbia, have you?
Yes, I'm from Comox. So I was born and raised in Comox on Vancouver Island. I did my undergrad at the University of Victoria, and most of my PhD consisted of working with seaweeds along the west coast of British Columbia and North America.
What got you involved in the writing of this new edition of the book?
Well, as a student of the seaweeds since 2004, when I first took Louis' seaweeds course at the Bamfield Marine Sciences Center, where his first edition of the Pacific Seaweeds book was one of the textbooks, I've wanted to be involved in such a project that got so many people knowledge about seaweeds for the general public, for their biodiversity, for how you can use them, and so it's been kind of an adult dream of mine.
Louis, I'm sure people ask you about the first edition of Pacific Seaweeds, and my understanding is it sold over 10,000 copies. What do you tell them in terms of why it did so well?
Do I have to be modest?
You can be whatever you like.
I think the book was written not just to be a guide, but to be a story,
mm-hmm.
a story of seaweeds. So as you're going through the various groups, and you can actually look at them on the beach, learn about the people that actually studied them, or interesting facts about them that doesn't really deal with your ability to identify them. Just makes it a more complete picture.
Yeah, and you do get a sense of the people. I mean, you profile a couple of them, a number of them throughout the book. If you had to I guess, ask you guys in terms of what got you interested in seaweeds and make that your life's work or your career in education, what do you tell them?
Do you want to go first, Louis?
What do I tell them?
Yeah. I mean, why seaweed for you?
It's, you know, as you go through life, you come to dichotomies, and you go this way or that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes reasonably, and sometimes just by blind chance. And so I did that, and I ended up in botany, and then I ended up with seaweeds, and then I ended up with kelp. It just seemed like each step took me closer to the things that I enjoyed.
Yeah, and I watched this clip of you on YouTube about, because you are an expert in kelp. I mean, you know practically everything there is to know on kelp, is that right?
I think so. There's one fellow in Germany that might argue about that.
And Bridget, for you?
Well, for me, I have always favored serendipity for helping me choose my path. I grew up on the beach. I was very fortunate to grow up right on the shore of Kai Bay in Comox. So seaweeds were around my whole life, but I never considered studying them. I was going to school for kinesiology, and then I got into biology, and I thought fish were my ride, my big love. And then when I took a fish course in Banfield in 2003, I saw the seaweeds course happening at the same time and thought they were cool. So the next summer I took a seaweeds course. I got along really well with the other professor from that course, Dr. Gary Saunders. He suggested I could do a master's with him, and it's sort of the rest is history. Every step of the way, something has come up that's made seaweeds seem more interesting. And the more I found out they were incredibly understudied as a group, the more I wanted to help add to our knowledge of this, these really amazing creatures.
Yeah, you work and you live in Monterey Bay now.
I do.
Yeah, so the kinds of seaweed that we would find, say, where you are, as opposed to the ones that were here in up in British Columbia, I mean, mm-hmm. there's great diversity in British Columbia itself. But have you found, I guess the Pacific seaweeds covers a certain area, right?
That's correct. So the range of our book covers what's called the cold temperate region. It's an oceanic region that runs from approximately Homer, Alaska, down to Point Conception, which is down around Santa Barbara in Southern California. So Monterey Bay is still part of the cold temperate region. We have quite a bit of overlap in seaweeds here in Monterey that you can find up in British Columbia, but there are also unique species to the areas as well.
And would some of these species be found, say, on the East Coast?
Yes, there are some species of seaweeds, like a very common, the rockweed, Fucus disticus, is found on both coasts.
Uh-huh.
But then you've also got lots that are endemic to these waters, like the bull kelp, the giant kelp that's on the cover of, the bull kelp nereocystis that's on the cover of the book, is something that really calls this area home.
And is there a reason why that happens, say, just in this part of the world as opposed to, say, in Asia or on the east coast of North America?
Some of it is, a lot of it is the history of the species. How old it is kind of dictates how long it's had to disperse to various places around the world, how well it disperses, if it floats very well, how long it can survive detached, how fast it grows, how quickly it spreads. All these things can influence whether you find them in different regions. Plus, there's just chance. Some things get carried to places and do well, and other things get carried to places and they don't do well.
You write in the book, a species might be found in Monterey Bay, nowhere else but, say, up near Haida Gwaii as well. And is there an explanation for something like that as to why you would, say, find it in Banfield or here in off of the coast here in Vancouver?
Yeah, so that's something that's actually an active area of research that my PhD advisor and Louis's former student, Dr. Gary Saunders, is working on, is trying to understand this pattern we're seeing where we've got some species that you can find in Haida Gwaii and then further south, but it seems like it's pretty patchy and it's not found in places in between. So not on Vancouver Island or very few places, and not in Washington and Oregon. There's a number of species showing this pattern, and it could be the different currents that carry these dispersing species, and it could also be a remnant of the last glaciation when Haida Gwaii is believed to have been a refugium for species, both marine and terrestrial, that were not covered by the glacier.
Louis, how has the study of seaweeds changed over the last 15 years? I mean, are there different techniques now than say, 15 years ago?
Yes, very differently. And the big one is the area that Bridge has been very active in pioneering, and that is using molecular techniques, studying DNA and comparing it amongst individuals of a species, between species, and amongst larger groups. So it's given us a lot of insight. And also, I could add quite a bit of pain for those of us that learn things the old way.
When you go to dinner parties or you talk to people like myself who know very little about seaweeds, what do you tell them in terms of just how vital they are, Louis, to just the ocean and to life itself? I mean, the future of seaweeds is very much tied to how healthy the ocean is, isn't it?
Oh, yes, definitely in the shallow waters. So throughout the region this book covers, kelp definitely is a major base of all the food chain. So kelp captures sunlight, converts it into energy-rich compounds, which then drive the whole ecosystem, everything from pelagic birds, fishes, crustaceans, mollusks, the whole show. So it's absolutely more than vital, it's crucial.
Yeah, and how have you found in terms of our appreciation of them or our realization just how vital they are? I mean, I'm assuming that because from my experience, do you find people just ignorant about seaweed?
Yeah, definitely. And I think today most people are still ignorant of seaweeds. Hopefully this book will cure that, at least to a large extent.
We are talking a lot about global warming and ocean acidification. I guess seaweeds are at the fore of that. When you study them, as you do, Bridget, you're keenly aware of both global warming and how the ocean is acidifying.
Yes, and seaweeds are a group believed to be or is already showing effects of changing climate. Ocean acidification, ocean warming is a big one for seaweeds because seaweeds, like almost all species, have a range of temperatures in which they can comfortably live and survive and thrive. And as the oceans warm, the distributions of seaweeds, we started to see changes in the distribution of seaweeds. So things that can handle warmer temperatures are moving north in our area as the water's warm, and things that can only handle cooler temperatures are either driven north or they could be. This is an active area of research, again, that's deserving of a lot more study than it's currently had. There are good people working on it. But seaweeds, if they can't move as a species, change their distribution, then they could be driven extinct.
Mm. And have you found some going extinct over the years?
I don't know. I would say that that's not. It's unfortunate that seaweeds are not studied as well as they should be. So we couldn't make that kind of statement. We've seen species that were present in an area previously no longer present in an area, but that's not to say that the entire species has gone extinct.
And Louis, do you find that you're asked about how edible seaweeds are? I mean, I guess the initial question as I had as started the book was, are all seaweeds edible? And I guess not, right?
Well, yes, they're not all edible. Some simply because they're like rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Others because they taste horrible. And a vast majority of them because they're just not interesting. But there are many species that are very interesting, very enjoyable and ingestible, yes.
I had a woman on from Haida Gwaii once, and she was talking about picking sea spinach with a friend, and is that the same as sea lettuce that you have in the book?
That's always a good question. The thing about common names and seaweeds just don't belong in the same room together. Not like birds or dogs that have common names that seem to be universal. So it's really hard to say. Just a real quick anecdote. I was invited to Haida Gwaii to give a talk on seaweeds. So I got up there and I gave about 15 minutes and then we took a break. And so this person walked up to me and she said, "I thought you were going to talk about seaweeds." And I said, "Well, I am." She said, "No, seaweeds." And it turns out they say nori, or what we call porphyra, or used to call it porphyra, is seaweed to them. That's their common name for it. And that's a group of algae that Bridget knows very well and about which I know very little. And there I was with a captive audience.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about kelp.
No, when we, because in the back of the book there are recipes, and I'm curious to know if, because I the only real seaweed that I've ever eaten, is that what you find in sushi, or these little snack things, you know, like they're made like chips, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Right off the top, I would think that seaweed is salty. Is it the same kind of salt that's bad for you that we're told not to eat?
Well, no, it's very different. The major salty substance is potassium chloride, which gives the same sensation in your mouth as sodium chloride gives, and of course, sodium is not good for you in excess.
Yeah. Say, Bridget, I was wondering about, we're hearing about red tide around this time of year. Can you tell if there's a bloom in a certain spot by how the seaweed reacts to it, say?
Well, red tide is a giant jump in population of certain types of plankton. So they're not seaweeds, but they may be phytoplankton, so they may also use sunlight to produce their food. And I, to the best of my knowledge, I have not seen a study where someone looked at the effect of a bloom of plankton on seaweeds themselves. But it would be a very interesting area to look at because, as you've probably heard, red tides and other tides can have pretty damaging effects on animals that are in their area.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's a good question.
Maybe I should study that aspect of seaweeds. <shouldn't I? laughs>
Well, that's the beautiful thing about seaweeds. Yeah. Like so many groups of organisms in the ocean, we just there's so much yet to know about their biodiversity, and then also about how they interact with each other and the processes in the ocean itself. It's just an amazing area of research.
Now, how should we react to seaweed? Because I remember I was at Stanley Park just over a year or so ago, and I noticed the kids were playing on the beach, and you know they were grabbing seaweed and chucking it, and another one you know grabbed some and put it on a stick and was waving it around. After reading this book, we ought to be more circumspect about how we interact with seaweed on anywhere, but especially those of us that live near beaches or that are in and around beaches, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So beach etiquette is something, yeah, we discuss in the book. And one thing I like to tell people, because often I hear that seaweeds are gross, is what I hear, seaweeds are slimy. And I try to give people some context by explaining that your interaction with seaweeds might be as washed up seaweeds on a beach, and they've been sitting in the sun for a while and they don't smell that great. And that's the seaweed equivalent of roadkill, right? So you don't think a deer is a beautiful creature when you see it, you know, as a carcass on the side of the road. Seaweeds washed up on the beach are usually dead, and they've usually been dead for a little while, so they may not be that pleasant. But even so, that wrack, as it's called, that gets washed up and collected in those lines along the beach tide line, that can be shelter for other creatures. Living in the sand or living in the beach. It can provide food for some of those creatures in the beach. So I like to think of it just like the rocks around the intertidal that you might flip over to have a look for some crabs. That's fine. I think curiosity and exploration is innate in all of us, and we should nurture that curiosity at the beach. But just if you flip over a pile of rocks or you pick up a piece of seaweed, just put it back where you found it because something might be using it as food or shelter.
Yeah. Louis, the kinds of seaweed that we find in urban centers like here in Vancouver, as opposed to say in remote places, are those different? And I guess what distinguishes where certain species grow?
Yeah, so just taking our local situation, say Banfield versus Vancouver, we have a very different regime of water temperature and salinity here. For example, right now I'm looking at how rain, and so we get our low salinities in the winter when it rains a lot. And around Vancouver, you get the low salinities when the Fraser River discharges the snow melt in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
So those are big differences between the two areas. And also there's just the impact of urbanization, people converting uplands from forest into streets with drainage, taking all kinds of strange things into the ocean. Mm. So there are those kinds of differences, yeah.
And the uses of seaweeds in pharmaceuticals, that's something that, how long has that been going on?
Well, I think everybody says it goes back to Chinese medicine, you know, thousands of years.
Uh-huh.
It's never really reached the kind of sophisticated state of our modern medicines. I think people tended to stay away from it, and people were kind of in love with chemistry more than going back to the folklore of how things have been used.
Uh-huh.
I think the only thing that's ever been successful is the aspirin, which has been known forever, and it's never been researched and never been challenged, and it's a great drug. But that we don't have that kind of a history with the seaweeds.
Well, the other thing that I was just thinking about is we spoke about red tide a minute ago, Louis. We're not supposed to eat certain seafood because of, say, the level of mercury in them. Do you find that there is mercury found in seaweed?
Yeah. If it's an element in a periodic table, it's found in seaweed. The question is, how much is there?
Yeah.
And in what form is it? I know we have a small company. We sell sea vegetables. And periodically, we get our products tested for the heavy metals, mercury, lead, and such. So we'd have to be kind of careful about that. I think the best advice is, if you're collecting seaweeds, which are known to be edible, collect them from a clean environment. I wouldn't collect in Vancouver waters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wouldn't collect in Parksville waters. I mean, I really like to get out, and that's where we are here in Banfield.
Yeah. The other thing that I was wondering about after reading your book, Bridget, was some of this. There's a section in the book where the seaweed is red. What makes them red as opposed to green, or the darker green that we're probably more used to seeing?
Oh, that's a great question, and I hope you can hear me okay, because
yeah.
It's getting a little choppy on my end.
Yeah, you sound fine.
Oh, good, okay. So there's three main groups of seaweeds, the reds, the browns, and the greens, and each has been evolving separately for millions and millions of years. And each has, even though they look quite similar, they have similar functions, they each have their own unique properties. And these properties include the pigments that they contain within their cells for capturing light for making their food. And so the reds appear red because of the suite of pigments that they contain. And then the greens appear greens because of the chlorophyll pigment that they contain. And the greens have few to no secondary pigments that mask the green color. The chlorophyll you find in all photosynthetic organisms is also present in reds and browns. But reds and browns each have secondary pigments that mask the green color you would see if it was just chlorophyll.
Hmm. Yeah, it's just, as I said, when I started the book, I knew little or nothing really about seaweeds, and after reading it and talking to you today, it's just fascinating me. Louis, there are recipes in the book, as I mentioned off the top. We overlook just the nutritional value that can be found in the ones that are edible, right?
Yes. To be quite honest with you, we don't really push the nutritional value so much.
Uh-huh.
They're definitely an excellent source of all your micronutrient requirements.
Uh-huh.
I don't think there's any group of organisms that's better. But beyond that, they're not very good. They don't have much in the way of protein. The brown algae, they're carbohydrates. They're sugars and starch-like substances we can't even digest. So they're not a good energy source, but they're a great fiber source, which is the flip side of not being digestible. So that's a good thing.
Yeah.
There's vitamins in them, and then there are a lot of other compounds, phenolics and such, antioxidants. A lot of these have not been really researched. They seem like likely candidates, and so a lot of people just don't wait for the research. They just go out and eat the kelp
yeah.
or the seaweed.
And so you've made the stuff in the back of the book, have you?
Oh, yeah. A lot of those recipes are my wife's.
Yeah. This has been such fascinating talking to you both. The thing that I've taken away from reading the book is that when I see this stuff on the beach, just not to step in it and throw it about.
That's a nice attitude.
Yeah.
I like that takeaway.
Yeah. Well, thank you both. You've done a great service. Congratulations on the second edition. I hope it does well for you both. Thanks for your time.
And thank you, Joseph.
Thank you.
The book is called Pacific Seaweeds, A Guide to Common Seaweeds of the West Coast. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its authors, Dr. Louis Druel, join me on the line from Bamfield, B.C., while Dr. Bridget Clarkson joined me from Monterey Bay, California. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.